We'll talk with the author of Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia during this hour, and we'll welcome your questions about the causes and consequences of eating disorders and what leads to recovery, full recovery. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, July 17th. According to the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, up to 24 million people of all ages and genders suffer from an eating disorder, and 20% of those who have anorexia will die prematurely from complications of the disorder. Our guest will share her experience with anorexia and bulimia and answer your questions and respond to your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Maria Hornbacher. She is the author of Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia, which is being re-released with a new afterword. She also teaches in the graduate writing program at Northwestern University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So remind us when you first wrote Wasted.
Wasted was written in 1997, released in 1998.
And why did you re-release it with a new afterword?
That was something that my publisher and I collaborated on because it was very important to both of us that the voice in that book, which is at that time a 22-year-old girl, be updated to the voice of someone in full recovery and many years older. So it was important to us to get a view from the other side of the disorder.
And let's start at the beginning, though. When did you first know or start showing the symptoms of having an eating disorder? Maria? I guess we lost our connection with our guest. So we will redial and get her back online. And we will also remind you that you can call in with your questions and experiences. Do you know someone who suffers from anorexia or bulimia? Do you know someone who has? Tell us about it. What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will talk with Maria about her experiences dealing with anorexia and bulimia, and we will talk with her what led to her full recovery. And we'll talk about this new afterword in this best-selling book that may be controversial. Is recovery from eating disorders a choice? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Okay, we've reestablished contact with our guest. Maria, sorry about that. Glad we have
no
you
problem.
Back. Well, why don't we just make sure everybody is on the same page? We've certainly heard a lot about anorexia and bulimia over the years, but what exactly is anorexia?
Anorexia is an illness in which the person who is afraid of traditionally fat, weight gain, and things like that, she begins to restrict her intake until she is at a very dangerous point of weight and medical instability.
And how is it related to bulimia?
Bulimia is, in a way, the sort of up-and-down version of anorexia. It's someone who takes in a great deal of food, purges by some means, whether violent, you know, self-attack or exercise, and that person is more stable by weight, but equally at medical risk.
And the purging is because there is still that fear of gaining the weight.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And when did you first have symptoms of these disorders?
Well, like many people now who develop eating disorders, it started quite young. I was about 9 when I began to suffer from bulimia. And by the time I was 14, it had morphed into a combination of bulimia and anorexia. Most people who do have disorders have a combination of symptoms of both disorders. It's very rare that one has either one or the other, absolutely.
So how long did this go on before parents or friends said, hey, what's going on?
Well, it was, I guess it was probably about 5 years that I was dealing with this quite on my own. A friend decided to report me to the health counselor at school in my junior high, which I'm deeply grateful for that she did step in and get me some help. So I was about 14 when we began looking at this issue.
And what did you think, what led to it?
The eating disorders often come from a variety of sources. I always look at them as sort of a three-pronged disorder.
I think we lost our guest again. Well, we're gonna take our break. We're gonna see if maybe there's another phone that we can call and continue to talk about anorexia and bulimia. What leads to these eating disorders? How are these eating disorders treated? What leads to full recovery? And we'll welcome your questions. We'll welcome your experiences. Perhaps you yourself have suffered from an eating disorder. Perhaps you know someone who has or is currently dealing with this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Kerdine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about eating disorders this hour with a woman who has suffered from and recovered from anorexia and bulimia. We'll talk about the psychology of eating disorders, their consequences, and what goes into a full recovery. Our guest is the author of Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia, which has been recently re-released with a new and perhaps controversial afterword. And we are welcoming your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Kerdine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Maria Hornbacher. She is the author of several books, most recently the updated edition of Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia. Let's, Maria, talk a little bit about how many people suffer from anorexia, bulimia, or other eating disorders.
Anorexia and bulimia are the most well-known eating disorders, and those affect about 1% of the population in America. It's higher in certain areas of the country. There's a new standard for binge eating disorder, and so that will adjust the number of people in this country who are thought to have eating disorders.
And is it considered a mental illness?
It is in the DSM-5 as a mental illness in that guide for mental disorders that people suffer from. It is considered also an addiction. And so along with alcoholism, it is filed under mental disorders, but also filed under the area of addiction.
Well, along those lines, John in Madison joins us. Hello, John.
Hi. There are two other mental illnesses that are associated with anorexia and bulimia, specifically depression and obsessive-compulsive disease. Depression, it's got a huge proportion of the population. I think something like a lifetime, 18% of the population develops a depression, and OCD affects 2.4% of the population. With what frequency do you find with depression and OCD anorexia and bulimia?
When I have seen and observed people who deal with eating disorders, and certainly in the research that is done on eating disorders, depression is highly associated with the development of a disorder, as is depression highly cited as a result of the disorders that people deal with. I think you'd see more incidence of of anxiety disorder than, precise obsessive compulsive disorder. There's a very high correlation between anxiety and the symptoms of anorexia and bulimia.
Yeah. Do mostly women suffer from these eating disorders, or are men also suffering from them?
Both men and boys are increasingly diagnosed with eating disorders. Certainly there have been many men who were not diagnosed prior to now, but while the awareness is growing, so is the population of men who struggle.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of heredity, do genes have anything to do with this?
That's a very hot topic in the research on eating disorders, as well it needs to be, that the research is finding that there are certainly genes associated with addictive properties in families. They don't know yet whether there is something that precisely predicates an eating disorder in someone who has a family member who has struggled as well.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to your story. You're 9 years old and you start binging and purging at 9 years old?
Correct.
And I mean, what was, describe this for us. When was the, how did this happen? What was the first time this happened? And what was going through your mind?
The first time it happened, I was really not paying much attention. I was, as I often did, snacking after school. And like a lot of kids, I was home alone and I had nothing to do but eat and watch TV. And I had developed a great deal of fear around my body, around fat, around becoming a female woman. And I decided that I was going to try and get rid of the snacks that I had been eating. And the best way I could think of to do that was to purge through vomiting. And so I did that. And the first time, it was very frightening. But I also felt a certain degree of power, which is one of the reasons that people do stay hooked into eating disorders for as long as they do.
And it was completely on your own that you thought, oh, I know, I'll vomit. Or had you heard that this was going on?
It was completely on my own, simply because I would simply point out that I was very young and didn't have a lot of influence from other kids' behavior at that time. Also, that would have been in 1980-something, and the awareness around eating disorders was not particularly widespread. So my awareness that there were symptoms was not very great. I simply knew that I wanted to get thinner and get rid of food.
And this fear that you had of I guess, your body, where do you think that came from?
It's really common, and this certainly happened for me, that girls and boys who enter puberty early and their body starts to change more rapidly than their peers, they become very aware of themselves as physically changing, whereas their peers are able to deal more with development at that time. These kids are faced with a whole range of issues that don't come up for, you know, quote-unquote, your average kid. And so my body was changing very quickly, and I didn't understand the source of that at all, and I tell you, I did not like it. And so my first experience, it's called body dysmorphia, an unawareness of one's actual body shape, a distortion of one's actual body shape. So disordered looking becomes something that is developing disordered behavior. And so my idea of what I looked like was quite a long ways from the reality.
Yeah. You know, I was a chubby child. I overweight to some extent, and I was self-conscious about it. But it never occurred to me that I'm going to starve myself or I'm going to vomit after I eat. What's the difference between, you know, why didn't I do what you did?
Exactly. It's such a good question. And I'll go back to what I think is the source and etiology of many people's eating disorders. I look at it as sort of a three-pronged source of those disorders, whereas you might have come from a family setting that was not chaotic, you might have come from a social arena that was not particularly pressureful, and you might be predisposed not to be a perfectionist. That's great. Then you probably won't develop the eating disorder. Someone who is highly perfectionistic and competitive, who comes from a family that has some problems and who deals with social pressures at an unusual level is more likely to develop that illness. And so, you know, there's a clear question. We're all in this culture, and why are some kids getting eating disorders and some adults getting eating disorders and others aren't? We all have the same pressures, but we're all coming to adulthood and to social pressures with different experiences in our lives.
Right. Well, I sure had that chaotic family, but that's another story. talk some more now about how you progressed with these eating. You started eating and purging, binging and purging as a 9-year old. When did it develop into anorexia?
For me, it was a very gradual descent into more and more restrictive eating and away from the binging and purging cycle. And then I went to boarding school when I was 15, and at that point I basically had less supervision than was necessary for me at that time, less supervision than would be ideal, and I was put in charge of my own eating. And that's not great for an eating disordered 15-year-old. And so at that point, the disorder morphed more into anorexia than it was, you know, similar to bulimia.
Yeah, and you were someone that would eat a leaf of lettuce then for your dinner with ketchup on it?
Well, I did a lot of carrots with mustard.
Carrots with mustard?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, in fact, I remember reading about someone who actually did an iceberg lettuce leaf with mustard on it, and mm-hmm. because she knew that there were no calories or very few calories in lettuce, and you know, virtually zero in the mustard. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So, when did you? I mean, what kind of physical consequences did you develop because of this?
Very early on, for one thing, you stunt your growth when you start eating and becoming malnourished at a very early age when you're still in a growth development period. So the first thing was that I'm 5 feet tall at 40, and I never got any taller than that than I was when I was about 10. So one thing is that one stunts one's growth. Another thing is that one weakens one's bones quite a lot. So my bones at this time are about 8 derivations less strong, more weak than someone my age. And so by the time I was 16 or so, I was dealing with a lot of broken bones, a lot of sprains. It damages the heart muscle. It damages the lung muscle. It damages all of the internal organs' ability to function. And certainly it affects the outer appearance. One's nails and hair become very brittle because, you know, we nourish our bodies so they work. And when we don't nourish them anymore, they don't work.
Boy, so when did you mentioned earlier that someone told on you? That's how you ended up getting into treatment?
Correct.
And tell us what the treatment was.
Well, treatment, my first treatment was not until a few years later. I think my family and I tried very hard to either not pay attention to the eating disorder or to tell ourselves that it wasn't that bad. So I actually didn't go into hospital-based treatment until I was 16 years old. By that point, of course, I've had the disorder for 7 years. And so the entrenched quality of it made it very difficult to treat. And eating disorders are hard to treat. My first treatment, I was in a hospital-based program. It was locked, as the programs were back then. I received mostly refeeding processes, so we ate a lot and didn't do a lot of psychological changing. And it was very much a revolving door sort of experience where you came in, you got refed, you stabilized medically, and then you went back out, you did it again, you came back in.
And you did relapse?
Many times. I was hospitalized for eating disorders 11 times in the course of about 5 years. And so that's close to a little over twice a year. And what it, I think, was caused by was that simple inability to grasp the basic roots of the eating disorder and take hold of them and change them.
Yeah. So what was the turning point for you? When did you do it for good?
I think that there are always multiple turning points. You know, we turn a lot of corners. The first one was when I was 19 years old. I was in the hospital on an intensive care unit, and I'm not entirely sure what clicked, but I really got stubborn and said, I don't want to die. I was very, very ill and had been given a life expectancy of about a week. And then this man who my family knew came in, sat down with me, and looked at me with huge frustration and annoyance. And he said, "What do you think you're doing?" And honestly, I had no answer. And after years of struggling with it, that simple question of, why are you doing this? What is your purpose? I really had no answer. And so the question of why I had valued thinness came into play, and I began to realize that there was so much more that I wanted to do with my life that I began to pursue that wellness.
Yeah. Marcus from Green Bay wants to know how you feel about the term disorders. He says it feels like a label to him, judgmental, that he thinks that's hurtful and harmful. What do you say to that?
I definitely think he has a point. You know, the language we use around health problems and medical problems and psychiatric problems can be very labeling, and it can make one feel like they are more, you know, segregated from the regular, quote-unquote, people in the world. I think he's got an excellent point in that most people are dealing with some form of, you know, quote-unquote, disordered eating. I think very few of us eat the way we're supposed to. And so people with eating disorders really struggle with that label that I have disordered eating while you people over there are fine. And so there's that continuum that we're really on. And the question of whether disorder is a helpful term, I think, is a very good question. Yeah.
Well, we'll welcome your very good questions after we check the news and any experiences you'd like to share. Have you suffered from anorexia or bulimia? Or do you know someone who has? Tell us about your experience. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is the author of the memoir, Wasted, which tells of her experiences with anorexia and bulimia and how she recovered. And we welcome your input, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. According to the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, up to 24 million people of all ages and genders suffer from an eating disorder. 20% of those who have anorexia will die prematurely from complications of the disorder. We are talking with a guest who is sharing her personal experience with anorexia and bulimia and answering your questions and responding to your views. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Maria Hornbacher, author of several books, including the best-selling Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia. She teaches in the graduate writing program at Northwestern University. Wasted was first released in 1998. It's been recently re-released with a new afterword. Well, let's go back to the phones. Janine in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You want my story? Or did the screener tell you?
No, you have to tell us.
Oh, okay. My daughter, bulimia, she was 15 or 16. She said something about suicide. I took her to the pediatrician. One visit, she was fine. I don't know what he told her or what. She can't remember. She says she can't remember. I wonder, did something very personal happen in that house? I don't know. Her cousin, anorexic, chronic anorexic, she's about 50 years old now, chronic anorexic. Also, I was just thinking also, my daughter's cousin, anorexic, from my side of the family.
Yeah. Well, Janine, I'm thank you for sharing that story. Her daughter shows signs of bulimia. One trip to the pediatrician, she says, and she's fine, but she knows another woman who's a chronic anorexic in her 50s. Maria, what do you suppose is going on there?
I think there are a number of important things going on there. Your question about the genetic link of eating disorders in family lines is very poignant here, and it's important that the research continue along those lines. What I think happens in a family is that there's a question of nature versus nurture. You know, what are the girls learning from the men and women who are older than them? What are we learning from our parents, our siblings, our cousins, our aunts and uncles? We are taught and we learn by example on many too many issues. It would be great if many of us didn't carry family traits down the line with us. There's also the fact that a young woman who has people around her who are suffering greatly from eating disorders could really be steered in the right direction by someone who strongly suggested to them that they needed to do something else with their life. And so the impact of one pediatrician's session is not necessarily too small there may be a person in someone's life who says, you need to go this other route. And I would compare it to someone who has trouble drinking in their early 20s but does not become an alcoholic, and someone who has trouble in their early 20s with drinking and by 30 is deeply alcoholic. So we go our way.
Yeah. Well, talk about, some people never recover from anorexia or bulimia.
That's true. And it makes me very sad and a little bit mad, to tell you the truth, because I believe, as you know, I believe full recovery is really possible. Whether it's possible for anyone is a larger question. But many people, about 40%, will never fully recover from their eating disorders. They will continue to have symptoms and struggles and medical problems due to anorexia and bulimia. About 10% are thought to recover fully. I want that number higher. I want that number to go up, because about 40%, again, go through ongoing struggles with their eating disorder lifelong. While they're not chronic, they are not content yet with bodies and food. And so what I want is to bump up that number of people who do fully recover.
Talk a little bit about today versus yesterday. You were suffering from this, I guess, mainly in the 80s. Treatments are better, different now than then?
Oh, gosh, yes. Symptoms are so much better now. I've been in recovery. I'm very lucky to say I've been in recovery for 20 years now. And so when I went into that stage of my life where I was getting ready to let go of my eating disorder and move on, I really struggled for maybe another 5 years, which is quite common. They say recovery takes 5 to 7 years before your eye is really restored, before your mental state is really restored, before your eating habits. So what happened with me was I struggled in the 80s. I struggled in the early 90s. But by the time I was in my mid-20s, I was really, I had really learned that I wanted a life more than I wanted this saddening disorder, this very difficult and painful disorder. And I had reached out to a great many people to help me with that. So the question of the way I lived yesterday, it's incomparable. The struggles mm-hmm. I had with food and weight back then are gone.
And you followed like a 12-step recovery program?
I do use that as part of my recovery. The 12 steps are very helpful for some people, not as helpful for others. I think the idea of eating disorders as addictions is still a fairly new idea, but I do know a great many people who the 12 steps have been very useful in letting go of their addiction and learning to manage their lives.
Mm-hmm. And in your afterword, you say that recovery is a choice. Why do you say it's a choice?
I say it's a choice. I'm going to return to the example of alcoholism. Insofar as we don't choose to become sick, I truly believe that eating disorders develop organically and are painful and are struggles. However, I do believe that at some point, we are given the opportunity to make the choice. Will I continue to worsen my illness, or will I take the right step and move into a time in my life where I am fighting that illness and recovering from my disorder? And so it's not a choice like you can say, yesterday I was eating anorexic and today I'm not. It's just not that quick. It's just not that simple. I wish that it was. And there's no pill, of course, that can make it happen. It's in many ways a very deep personal and spiritual struggle to let something go that has affected you so profoundly and move into a new way of life.
Yeah. And tell us the story about how making soup with a friend was a pivotal moment in your recovery.
You know, that's a great, I love that story. It's my friend Ruth, who remains my dearest friend. She decided when we met that she was going to teach me to eat, because at that time I literally didn't know how to open a can and make myself dinner. And she said, we're going to learn to make soup. It's the easiest thing in the world. And so she taught me by example that there doesn't need to be the rigidity around food, that there doesn't need to be the fear around food, that there is the element of communion around food that one can share with friends and family and no longer isolate oneself from those people and no longer isolate oneself in the disorder. So she taught me really to enjoy food, to not only cook, but to take part in that experience with people, especially at first with her.
And so today you can eat a bowl of soup with gusto, or do you still have a little nagging thought in the back of your head saying, you know, how many calories is in this?
Not a bit. I absolutely can eat very easily. I'll tell you, I'm extremely good at making soup after all these mm-hmm. years of practice with Ruth. soup is, for one thing, an easy one. I think many people with disorders don't struggle with things like soup. However, I can also eat a hamburger with gusto. I can eat pasta with gusto. Those foods that used to be so scary with me no longer are, because food has stopped being the enemy. What's the enemy now is my own fear.
And so do you experience that fear still?
I experience fear of life, and I truly believe that the experience of addiction and of eating disorders in particular is the experience of being afraid to move on in one's life. One traps down oneself and one's life in controlled settings, and so that the world becomes that counting, the food, the calories, the weights, the sizes, that draws experience into a very manageable little world. However, you know, the rest of us who have to go through our lives day by day, we don't have that simple manageable mechanism to make things simpler for ourselves. We deal with pain. We deal with grief. And so we deal with loss and anger and joy. As I go through my life now, I think I experience the same degree of fear as your average bear. I think I just know how to deal with it in a way I didn't know how to deal with it before.
Mm-hmm. And you can look through a fashion magazine and compare yourself to the images you're seeing?
Honestly, I stopped looking at women's and fashion magazines so many years ago. I don't know what my response would be now, because truly, I do believe that people in the media are well-meant, and I also know that skinny sells magazines, weight loss sells magazines, and so I don't think the media is, you know, on a mission to make women and men ill. But I do think the representation of beauty in these magazines is horrifyingly unhealthy. And so, just for my own purposes, I don't want to engage in it. I don't want to trigger, you know, that unhappiness, that longing, not just for thinness, but for all of it, all those things we're supposed to have and don't have. I don't want to get engaged in that. I don't want to make myself feel less than.
Scott in Wisconsin Rapids has been waiting. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to mention a kind of an interesting thing that happened to me 2 years ago. I needed to lose about 40 pounds. I'd kind of let myself go a bit. So I got in a nice program. They were real helpful. The only trouble is I did so good at it, I lost about 55 pounds and got to those goals and got past them. I was thinking everything was great and kept thinking, wow, I'm just going to keep going down and down, and my pant sizes shrunk, and I was real happy about it until I realized just what I was doing to myself, and I started looking at pictures of myself, and it was just amazing to me that must be what it feels like. You're suddenly in control of what you're eating. You're in control of your weight. And I got that taste of what that must feel like to people to get to that size and not realize that maybe this isn't healthy for you. Maybe you're fooling mm-hmm. yourself.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, Maria. Do you have a reaction to that?
Absolutely. It's so important that Scott called, because there is so much similarity between our experience as eating disorder people and people without eating disorders. Scott went through that snowball effect of getting the encouragement and the feedback that he looked great, you know, that the sizes were fitting him better, everything like that. And he, as he said, kind of went too further with that and got obsessive about that in a way that he wasn't expecting to. A lot of people start their eating disorder with a well-intentioned diet. And that's something that can, for certain people, not everyone, obviously, but for certain people, that can get out of control.
Yeah, I did lose quite a bit of weight on a Weight Watchers program. I guess I can kind of understand, you know, that there is a feeling of, wow, this is great. I can do this. So that feeling of being in control and having that power, even though you really aren't in control, is a big part of
yeah.
the disorder, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think the feeling of control is both illusory and somewhat delusional, because as I was unable to choose to eat dinner, that felt like control. But if someone said to me, you have to eat dinner, I'm screaming and yelling and turning things over. That's not control. And so addictions are by their nature out of control, unmanageable, and they would make one's life out of control and unmanageable as well. That taste of power, though, early on, with an eating disorder, you're so often congratulated for, oh, you lost weight, you look great, and so you just keep going. And you think, thin is better, and I'm going to get thinner. and all things point to the good. If I look better, get thinner, et cetera, we're all told that we're going to be happier if we lose a little weight. And some of us get hooked on that, and some of us keep going and we go too far.
Yeah, it's funny, though, because then there were some people in my life, though, that would say, you know, first there was that, oh, you look great, and are you losing weight, and all that. But even though I was at a very healthy weight, I was not, according to the Weight Watchers scales, I was, in fact, at the higher end of my range. And people were thinking, oh, my goodness, what's wrong? You know, you're losing too much weight. You're looking gaunt. You're looking too skinny. So it was, it's a matter of perception, I guess, too.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that you're talking about here is how much feedback we give each other way too much feedback about our bodies. You know, if someone comes up to me and says, you know, you're really short, I think that's dangerous, I'm going to be like, you know, it's none of your business whether I'm short. And so someone who doesn't have an eating disorder may be really taken aback by someone saying, you don't look good. I don't want to hear that now. But when you're ill, this is one of those experiences with an eating disorder that's hard to get. Someone with an eating disorder wants to be told that they look sick. Saying to someone, you look really healthy, translates in their mind to you look fat. It's the only illness that people will rather look sick than look better. And so there's that distortion in one sense of, you know, who I am, what I look like, and everybody's given me feedback. And we all talk about weight and look so much that we get caught up in that.
Oh, my goodness. So did you know when you looked sick that you were too thin? Or did you look in the mirror and say, gosh, I still need to lose some weight?
That's so interesting because you do look in the mirror. I did look in the mirror and say, this is too much. I need to lose more weight. And it's really by then not about the weight. That becomes symbolic of all you're trying to do. You're trying to control your emotions. You're trying to control the people in your life, your work, your school, et cetera. And you're doing it by managing your body and controlling the way that you look and controlling what you eat. So, yes, I thought, you know, at some terribly low weight, I'd look in the mirror and say, not light enough, not thin enough, because it's an end game. There is no light enough. There is no thin enough. There is no perfect person who thinks that they have really finally achieved satisfaction. There is no satisfaction with this illness. You will never achieve that perfection that we seek. And so what we don't understand when we have eating disorders is that is not perfection. That is death. And it's a really scary thing to think about. So many people who struggle with basically a real fight with life, not so much a real fight with fat.
We are talking with Maria Hornbacher, author of Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia. We welcome your questions, your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation with Maria Hornbacher, author of Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia. We have a number of Facebook comments and also a tweet from Jacqueline. What role does body monitoring play in anorexia? I guess that's what we're just talking about, looking in the mirror, body monitoring.
Yes, absolutely. People who struggle with that too much attention to their body, so much awareness of their size, their shape, their bone structure, et cetera, people do get out of control with that. That body monitoring can become extreme. It can become food monitoring. It can become size monitoring. And eventually it can become an eating disorder. So she's right to say that there's a link.
And Deb writes on Facebook, a little different twist here. My daughter is a beanpole. Classmates always say she is bulimic and anorexic. Apparently she's not. She'll come home and say, why can't I call them fat? What kind of answer do you have for her?
I think she's got a good point. Again, that's that issue of too much feedback on our bodies. I think it's appropriate for kids to say to someone who they really think is ill, I'm worried about you. But it's unfortunate that we feel we have the right to say, you're too skinny, you're too fat. She's got a point. And I feel like kids who are born with some kind of body shape that's not, quote unquote, the norm, really suffer from that. Whether they're heavy or whether they're thin, there's too much talk to kids about their bodies.
Julie in Oconomowoc is with us now. Hi, Julie.
Hello there.
Yes, you have a story, an experience to share?
Yes, I was anorexic for 13 years, and while I was in the trenches of it, I never thought I would be able to recover and actually be able to eat what I call, you know, what normal people would eat today. And I think for myself, it really took a point of, you know, hitting rock bottom, coming to that near-death experience, and really having the support of my loved ones around me to say, hey, look, you are going to die, and having to actually go through therapy time after time again and get to a point where I thought, you know, I'm back on track and I can do this myself, and only to relapse a few, you know, months or years later. It hit rock bottom for myself, and that's really what changed my life, turned me around. And I've been happy to say that I've been fully recovered for 13 years, and it is absolutely possible and doable. And I don't think about food. I don't think about calories or weight or anything else. And like the author, I don't look at magazines anymore. I don't read the fashion news, because those are all things that I think, again, society puts way too much emphasis on and can really get people drawn back into it.
Mm-hmm. Maria?
Oh, so good to hear from you. It's so popular to say, oh, I'll always deal with this eating disorder. But it's so empowering to hear men and women talk about their full recovery, their recovery process, the things that help them get strong. It's rare that people who are dealing with eating disorders right this minute hear that message, and it is the message we have to get across. We can recover. This is not a lifelong track. We can move out of it as we strengthen, as we get support. And so, absolutely, her story is so inspiring, so empowering, because real recovery is something many people think isn't possible for anorexia and bulimia, but it is possible. It's strengthening and it's possible.
So what's your advice for someone dealing with anorexia or bulimia right now?
I would ask them to really sit and think for a minute, what am I valuing right now by this pursuit of thinness and weight, etc.? Is that a value I can carry into my life? Is that something that will live with me? Do I feel a passion for that in the way that I feel a passion for art or athletics or business or something? I would ask them to think about, why are you doing this thing where you are going to cut yourself off from all of your opportunities? You're going to keep yourself from going anywhere in your life, and you could go anywhere if you just set this aside.
Yeah. And is there, in our final minute, anything society can do to further improve this situation when it comes to those suffering from anorexia and bulimia?
I do. I think that we can each, this sounds cheesy, but we can start with ourselves. If we sit down with our friends at lunch and chit-chat about lunch and our weight and bodies, and then we go home and we talk to our daughters and our husbands and our friends about our weight and our bodies, we can't be too surprised that we're developing eating disorders among young people. We have to recognize that our own obsession with weight and body is too high, and we need to start having a healthy relationship with food and our bodies.
A word to the wise. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Maria Hornbacher, author of many books, her most recent, Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia, which was just re-released with a new afterword. She teaches in the graduate writing program at Northwestern University. Thanks to Robin Cherry and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Tomorrow at this time, it's Tell Joy Where to Go, and we are going to talk about a Wisconsin treasure tomorrow. Cheese curds. That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.